My name's Paul Hansen. I teach history at California Lutheran University. And the topic of this session is Islamic revivalism or fundamentalism in Asia, with a particular focus on Pakistan and a little bit with Malaysia. This in some ways is, I've been here now a week, and this in some ways is a kind of a bridge session to my second week. One or two of you have actually been around for the first part of this, but for those of you who are not, this last week I looked at the phenomenon of religion and political conflict in the Middle East in a variety of contexts, but specifically looking at the revolution in Iran and the situation in Lebanon, and some of the spread of fundamentalism to other Islamic countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and so forth. Now, this week, I'd like to move on to the general problem of religion and political conflict in Asia. And we'll begin with Islam again in this context, but then in the rest of the week, move on to some other kinds of conflict that are religion-based or at least identified as religious conflicts, the Sikh rebellion in the Punjab in India, and the Buddhist Tamil conflict in Sri Lanka, for two of them. And then we'll have a general session on Saturday about wither fundamentalism and maybe talk about some generalizations about the whole process and the future, something historians are not very good at all, but I'll be quickly getting out of town after it, so I won't need to worry about being tarred and feathered.
When you use the word fundamentalism, what do you refer to?
It's a good question, because I'm not real happy with the term. I've chosen the term essentially because it has been widely used in the media that way, and I thought people would have a better idea of what I was talking about, because it's particularly mentioned in relationship to Islamic fundamentalism. I think revivalism is a little bit better term, but it is a kind of militant assertion or reassertion of one's religious identity, and often is characterized in terms of these movements with a political program which intends to implant that version or vision of what my religion requires on the rest of a society or embodied in a political structure. And I think it tends to be, give you one other generalization that seems to be following up with it. It tends to be focused a lot, at least in terms of its observable characteristics, on enforcing correct practice on people, developing a lifestyle, a way of life that is in accordance with the faith, and oftentimes results in a kind of literalist interpretation of whatever fundamental authorities are within the tradition too. Those are some of the characteristics I guess I would refer to here. There are some key differences in comparison to the Islamic revival in the Middle East when we move to Asia. And I want to mention a couple of them so that we have some kind of context in which we're going to bear up with the information that follows. One obvious one is that, and here maybe I should put the map up, one obvious one is that Islam is more recently established in most parts of Asia than in the Middle East. Sounds like a self-obvious fact, but it has some important consequences. If we look at this map of Asia, where are Muslims? Well, Muslims extend down from Afghanistan and Pakistan. These areas are almost exclusively Muslim. Across India, in which there is a substantial Muslim minority population, to Bangladesh, which is over 80% Muslim, then down here to Malaysia, where there's a majority of the population which is Muslim, and Indonesia here, which is the largest Muslim country in the world, with at least 90% of the population professing some form of Islam, and with a total population of something like 125 million or so now. In fact, although we identify Islam primarily with the Middle East, most of the world's Muslims are in this part of the world. And that's another reason for talking about Islam in Asia, because the developments that are occurring in the Middle East may, in some fashion or other, have their effects in this greater part of the Muslim world. As I mentioned last week, after Indonesia, the two largest Muslim populations or countries with Muslim populations are Bangladesh and Pakistan. Bangladesh is an amazing country here. We have a territory of about the size of Wisconsin with a population of over 100 million people. India. India, a country in which Muslims make up approximately 11% of the population, which sounds like a relatively small minority, but then when you talk about a total population of 800 million, you suddenly have a Muslim population then of 85 to 90 million people inside India. China is another place where there is a substantial absolute number of Muslims, even though a relatively small percentage. There are probably something like 35 million Muslims in China. There are smaller Muslim minorities in other parts of Asia. Probably the most important one to mention is in the Philippines, particularly in the southern islands down here, where they have been fighting a rebellion for over a decade. In fact, I think for about two decades now, the Moros or Filipino Muslims, which comprise about 5% of the total population of the Philippines, are a much higher percentage being concentrated in those southern islands there. So one factor that makes this group different, other than the fact that they're such a vast number, is that, as I say, Islam came later to this area. Virtually all of the Muslims in these territories that I've mentioned here accepted Islam in one form or another, say, after the 11th or 12th centuries. when it expanded out of Arabia, had one major wave of expansion that was dominated by the Arabs. And you can pretty well divide the Islamic world into those territories that were part of that first expansion, and then the territories that came out of the secondary and tertiary expansions. If you look at the stretch of territory that stretches across North Africa, from Morocco all the way through the Middle East to Iran, except for Iran, all of those countries are Arabic-speaking countries. And in all of those territories, virtually the entire population eventually converted to Islam. So the degree of cultural transformation with these two key ingredients, that is the Arabic language and Islamic identity, was much more severe in that part. Because the process starts something like anywhere from 300 to 500 years later in the rest of this expansion of Islam, there has been no widespread linguistic acceptance of Arabic, for one factor. And the degree of Islamization that has taken place in these societies is less as well. The result is we have a couple of other characteristics of this Islam in Asia. One would be that indigenous religious traditions are combined and mixed with the messages of Islam that came from Arabia to a much greater extent than they are in those lands of the early Islamic conquests. And a final factor, one which I want to stress in terms of discussion for most of the rest of the session today, is that Muslims in Asia are either a minority, or a bare majority in many places, and must therefore have to work out some kind of relationship with other faiths on a continual basis. That's been the history of these Islamic communities in Asia. And that's a problem that Muslims in the Middle East, for the most part, have never had to face because of that great conversion and transformation culturally and religiously. This has made it difficult for Muslims in this part of the world because the models that they were drawing on in their faith and their historical tradition of Islam didn't have case examples in which this had occurred. And they have therefore had to struggle on their own with this kind of a problem. Why focus particularly on Pakistan, which is what I'm going to use for most of my information? Well, I have two real reasons for doing this. One is that it's South Asia is the area that I know most about. South Asia is the term generally applied to not just India here, but Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal, Bhutan, this area here, along with Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is as a contrast to Southeast Asia over here. I have more information about this area. And a second factor would be, as I mentioned, that when you take these three countries together, Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh, you have the second, third, and fourth largest Muslim populations in the world, so they count for something in terms of what they mean in the entire context of Islam as well. I mentioned this idea about minorities, and some of you may well know that the population of Pakistan today is about 98% Muslim, so what am I talking about? Well, you also, I'm sure most of you know, that Pakistan is a relatively new phenomenon, and that culturally, historically, and in many other ways, this has been a unified area for most of its history, and therefore the Muslims in Pakistan and Bangladesh for many, many centuries saw themselves as a minority here within the whole Indian subcontinent. And the reason for the creation of these two states, in fact, is that feeling of being a minority, as we'll talk about here in a moment. Well, let's maybe launch. If there are any comments or questions about this sort of overview of Islam in Asia before we move on to the next stage. The next stage is a kind of sketchy history here of the Islamic community, in particular in South Asia, as a background to understanding what some of the dynamics are of the Muslim states of Pakistan and Bangladesh now, and some of the fears and problems that they have for the future. As I mentioned, Islam came into India with the beginnings of the 12th century. Now, there was an early occupation of this small delta region of the Indus River at the time of the early Arab expansion, but that never really amounted to any kind of missionary impulse from that region. Instead, Turks from up here in Central Asia, beginning in the 12th century, after being newly converted to Islam, began to raid from bases in Afghanistan, the very wealthy Indo-Gangetic plain here across North India, and began to discover that they could not only raid, but stay as conquerors. These Muslims who then settled as conquerors across North India were always conscious from the outset that they were a relatively small minority ruling a potentially hostile non-Muslim population, and constantly had to struggle with how this should be done and yet remain true to Islam. For example, the Orthodox Muslim interpretation of how non-Muslim peoples should be treated was, of course, established in the Quran and then in the early practice of the Islamic community as they came out of Arabia. And the concept called the peoples of the book, the Ahl-e-Kitab, was established in which Christians and Jews were seen to be protected people because, after all, they too had been sent prophets earlier. They had distorted the message as far as Muslims were concerned, but their scriptures were held in reverence, and therefore they should be free to practice their faith with tolerance because they too had been part of the prophetic history that had culminated with Muhammad. An interesting sidelight to that is that in Iran, when the Zoroastrians realized that you needed to have sacred revealed scriptures in order to get protected status, hurriedly wrote them down when the Muslims were coming in order to try to acquire the same kind of status.
Get a
sacred book. Because for the most part, a lot of the religious traditions of the Zoroastrians had been passed down orally through the priesthood, and they didn't want them in books because they might be able to be accessed by other people. But in any case, that was certainly not a doctrine that could be applied once you came to India, where you were confronted with all of these polytheists, the very people that the Quran said didn't deserve protection, that ought to be slain because they would have been analogous to the polytheists in pre-Islamic Arabia. And yet the physical impossibility of actually slaying the many millions of Indians, aside from the impracticality of where would your wealth come from if you killed all the people who were paying taxes, meant that they immediately had to compromise in terms of what the faith required and the realities of the situation. This kind of compromise characterized in many ways the subsequent history of the Islamic community in India. They were willing to make compromises as long as they maintained political domination, because no matter how much the original vision of Islam may be fudged in some way from some pristine version of 7th century Arabia, it could be still justified and sanctified by the fact that this was, in fact, a Muslim state because Muslims were ruling. One of the other primary ways in which this was accommodated to Indian culture was by the extensive propagation of Islam through Sufis or Islamic mystics, who quite naturally, given certain currents in Indian religion, which are quite mystical, were able to strike resonant chords with certain numbers of the population and provide a kind of bridge figure which would be revered by both Muslims and Hindus. The takeover of India by the British, a process which began in the late 18th century and really was pretty well completed by the first half of the 19th century, was a traumatic thing for Muslims then. It left them in a quandary. Now, and actually you can almost date when this happens since it happened in 1858, when the British Crown, after a mutiny by the Indian Army, took over the direct rule and administration of India and gave Queen Victoria the new title Empress of India. Before that time, there was the legal fiction of the Mughal Emperor of India still ruling in his palace in Delhi, although long since reduced to a kind of figurehead ruler, but it was a very convenient fiction both for British and for the Muslims, in that he was a cloak of legitimacy for the British to extend their operations, and he was, of course, still the legal ruler of India, and so Muslims could continue to argue, at least to themselves, that they were ruling under, they were living under a Muslim state. But with the deposition of the last Mughal emperor after this mutiny in 1858, they're put face to face with this question: can a good Muslim live as a law-abiding citizen in a non-Muslim country? something, as I say, that hadn't been really a problem Muslims had had to face almost anywhere else in their history before this. There were a couple of possible responses, and we find them happening in the 19th century among the Muslim community there in India. One would be clearly, no, you can't. There's no way in which you can continue to be a good Muslim and accept political domination from non-Muslims, and therefore your obligation is to fight. There were numbers of jihad movements, holy war movements among South Asian Muslims there, which were all unsuccessful, but which tended gradually to, as British conquest, by the way, came from an opposite direction from the way conquests were usually done in India. Almost all conquests before the British always came from the northwest on down. But the British used sea power, and so they came inland from the coast, from Madras, from Bombay, from Calcutta, and especially from Bengal up this way. So the last areas, in fact, that wound up being acquired by the British were these areas up here in the northwest, which were areas where there were a substantial numbers of Muslims as a result of the centuries of invasion, and areas where Muslims who had come under British rule here might flee to if they had been unsuccessful in their resistance movements, jihad movements. As those options of violent resistance, though, were closed off, there were other responses that came forth from the community, and one was a kind of introspective quietism, I suppose you could term it, where Muslim leaders suggested to their fellow believers that the best thing to do was to create a kind of inward-looking Islam, which tried very hard to follow the rules and regulations of Islamic law, which tried to have as little to do as possible with the state and with the government, not to cooperate in any way whatsoever. And under those kinds of conditions, maybe the community could purify itself enough so that this too shall pass, that this will be a temporary phenomenon, and when we are righteous enough, God will again see fit to establish Islamic sovereignty over the community. This obviously became the only possible response once the British had pacified everything but the tribes on the northwest frontier. And it had another rather ominous impact on the future history of the Islamic community. Because relatively few Muslims then were willing to collaborate with the British, very few of them took advantage of Western-style educational opportunities that the British set up. Instead, the people who flowed into these new English language institutions and who then came out to be the clerks and surrogate bureaucrats of the British Raj were almost invariably all Hindu. And the gap in terms of the two elites, the Muslim elite and the Hindu elite, tended to grow very dramatically in cultural terms. Under the Muslims, particularly the Mughal Empire, that elite had shared a great deal of common culture. The Mughal emperors had incorporated Hindu warriors into their military system. They served as bureaucrats. They served, in fact, in many ways under the Muslims, as now many of these were willing to serve under the British. They were simply switching masters. It wasn't as big a deal for them. But for the Muslims, it was extremely different situation, and many of them refused to cooperate, and as a result, very few of them obtained Western-style educations. One important figure in the late 19th century, a man named Syed Ahmad Khan, saw the necessity for the Islamic community to change their ways. He was among the few Indian Muslims who traveled to the West. He saw London, Paris, traveled around in Europe, was mightily impressed, of course, in the 19th century with the accomplishments of Western civilization, science and technology, and felt that the Islamic community, which was already quite far behind, was going to get even worse if they did not make some accommodation to it. He went back to India, founded a kind of modernist Islamic movement, which had its most important manifestation in the founding of a college at Aligarh, which is just south of Delhi, for Muslims, and where the intent would be to try to combine Islam with modern thinking, science, and technology. It was also in the later stages of the 19th century that an Indian nationalist movement began to emerge. It began to emerge precisely among this Western English-educated elite, who the British had trained to help them as collaborators in the ruling of India, but who, as racism and ironically became stronger and stronger as the 19th century went on, as a result of social Darwinism, as a result of the reaction to the mutiny and the atrocities that occurred on both sides, as a result of these factors, this elite whom they had trained to collaborate, they no longer fully trusted. And they refused to promote them to positions commensurate with their talents and to open up avenues of opportunity for them. At the same time, the British increasingly decided to throw their lot in with the more conservative princely state rulers who they felt would be more likely to be able to control the masses for them. And as a result, the frustrations of this Western educated class turned them increasingly to nationalistic aspirations and the founding of a nationalist movement. But Muslims were almost entirely excluded from that movement, not by choice of the nationalists, but by choice of the Muslims, who felt, again, that they would have very little advantage to a nationalist vision that included implementation of Western-style political ideas, such as democracy. After all, if you're a minority and it's one man, one vote, where are you going to be? You're always going to be a minority. You're going to have a very difficult time, at least in your own mind, of electing people to positions of power. So they tended to stay aloof from that nationalist movement. But as more and more graduates started coming out of Aligarh and other institutions then that were founded in order to give Muslims a leg up on modern education, many of these Muslims also became nationalist. Their quandary was whether they should join in with the Hindu nationalists and form a kind of united front against the British, or should they develop their own nationalist movement. And this was the kind of dilemma, in fact, that affected the Islamic community in South Asia for most of the first three decades of the 20th century. The majority view, I would say, for most of this time was that most Muslims were too afraid to join the larger nationalist movement and preferred to work on their own. They founded a separate nationalist movement in 1906 called the Muslim League. And when efforts were made by the two elites to collaborate, to provide a united front against the British, they did so only when the Hindu nationalists made important concessions. The most important was establishing the idea of separate electorates, the notion that in proportion to their population, Muslims would always be able to elect just as many seats in a legislative assembly or officials in a local council or whatever. That there would be seats or positions set aside only for Muslims, for seats then which only Muslim candidates could run for, to guarantee that there would always be Muslims in there, that they wouldn't be outvoted in any kind of general elective pattern. This compromise was the beginning of a period of close cooperation between the nationalist elites. And India was fortunate at the end of World War I to have a leader like Gandhi emerge, which could hold this coalition together. Gandhi was a unique individual in a number of ways, and I imagine many of you have seen the David Lean film on Gandhi's life, which highlights in very effective fashion certain of the key experiences in his life. But one of the unique things about Gandhi was that he learned about India outside of India. He learned what his identity was outside of India. In England, where he went to school to study law, and then in the formative years of his life, up until his early 40s, with the Indian community in South Africa. This gave him a totally different perspective than most Indians had. Instead of seeing himself as a member of a particular caste or a particular religious group, Gandhi had this broader vision of what an Indian was because he had been treated as an Indian in these other areas and arenas. And when he began to operate politically in South Africa, the Indian community there was so small that he, of necessity, had to get the cooperation of all Indians. And he worked extensively then to get Indian Muslims and Indians of different castes, different linguistic backgrounds to all work together in his movement. Because he was successful there on that small scale, he believed, probably with a great deal of hubris, that that could be done with India as a whole when he went back. And only someone with his persistence, fortitude, and unique combinations of spiritual and practical political qualities could probably have pulled this off. Gandhi was also fortunate in that when he returned to India and became an important factor in the nationalist movement right after World War I, a couple of other circumstances had occurred which made it a very propitious time for developing an alliance with the Muslims. And this was the first mass agitation that the Muslims had mounted in India since the British had come. This mass agitation was called the Caliphate Movement. Now, this is the way it was spelled in India. It actually is derived from the word caliph, the way it's usually anglicized here. And it had to do with the fact that as World War I had ended, the Ottoman Empire had been on the losing side. Now, something I neglected to mention as an option that Indian Muslims adopted in the 19th century was tied in with things that were happening over in the Ottoman Empire, and it was this, that as the Ottoman Empire became weaker politically, the sultans of the Ottoman Empire resurrected an old title that had long since fallen into disuse in the world of Islam, and that's the title of caliph. They made a rather spurious or suspicious link to the original caliphs and as to how that dispensation had been passed to them. But the essential meaning of the title was that the Ottoman Sultan was claiming to be the political head of the whole Islamic community in the sense that the successors or caliphs had been to the Prophet Muhammad. So that even if you didn't live under the political jurisdiction of the Ottoman Empire, you could look to the Ottoman Sultan as the head of the Islamic community and therefore consider yourselves to be part of the Ummah or the whole community. Indian Muslims then picked up on this idea in the 19th century, and many of them saw themselves then as having a direct tie to the Ottoman Sultan as caliph. And they would read the Friday sermon in the name of the Ottoman Sultan, etc., where traditionally you would insert the name of the ruler. They didn't insert Queen Victoria. They inserted the Ottoman Caliph in Constantinople or in Istanbul instead. But now it appeared as if the whole Ottoman Empire was going to be carved up after World War I, and among other things, the status of the Ottoman Sultan himself was in question. And in order to put pressure on the British to treat the Ottoman Sultan, or Caliph as the Indian Muslims saw him, with respect, dignity, and make sure that his position was preserved, the ulama, or religious leaders of the Indian Muslims, began to stir up the population to demonstrate against the British on behalf of that, and that was what was called the Caliphate Movement. Gandhi saw this as a unique opportunity to weld the two groups together. He would support them on their demands regarding the Caliphate Movement, and he would then help them develop a strategy of massive non-cooperation, which would, if he could draw the Muslims into it as well, help paralyze the British Raj and be the strategy that would convince them eventually to leave. So this was the basis of the initial coalition, and it held together during Gandhi's first major non-cooperation movements in the early 1920s. But then, as some of you who were here last week remember, then events in Turkey overtook the Caliphate Movement. That is, Mustafa Kemal Ataturk emerged as the leading Turkish nationalist. He was a rabid secularist who thought Islam quite backward. He unilaterally abolished not only the Sultanate but the Caliphate and proceeded to strip Islam from as much authority as it had in Turkey as possible. Well, this was something they couldn't blame the British for, and yet it was something that had been the mobilizing factor in bringing the Muslims out into the streets. And it was difficult after that point in the early 1920s to continue to hold large numbers of Muslims in the nationalist movement, although it had galvanized a number of them, and because of Gandhi's continual stress on Indian unity and the brotherhood of all faiths and his use of Quranic literature in his devotional time, as well as Hindu scriptures and Christian scriptures, it helped hold some of these nationalists in the movement through the 20s and 30s, but many of them simply went back and became politically apathetic. This was in part due also to a concerted British strategy, which, although British officials would deny it, I think is pretty clear, and that's the obvious strategy of divide and rule. When you can play one group off against the other, it becomes a lot easier when you're a small minority to control things. And the British certainly played upon Muslim fears as to what would happen to them as this nationalist movement got stronger, as to what would happen to them if the British would leave. The British cast themselves in the white man's burden, paternalistic image in which they were protecting all the minorities, the poor, the oppressed, and that if they left, then anybody who was in that kind of minority position would certainly suffer at the hands of the majority. The person who most fully developed this fear on the Muslim side was Muhammad Ali Jinnah. And again, those of you who saw the Gandhi movie may remember him. He's the aristocratic type in three-piece suits with a monocle, cigarette holder, right. Jinnah was the epitome of the westernized, secularized Muslim. He was an extremely bright lawyer. His problem was that his ambitions were much greater than the possibilities that were there for him. There was no way in which he could become the head of the whole Indian nationalist movement. After all, as a Muslim, it just didn't fit. And besides, he really, and this was his other problem is vis-a-vis leaders like Gandhi, he certainly didn't have the common touch. He was an aristocrat. He didn't like mixing with the masses. But he was a brilliant man, and he saw himself that way. And he became extremely discouraged as to what his eventual role would be in any kind of independent Indian state, much less his role now in the nationalist movement when Gandhi began to shape the movement in the way in which he did. Jinnah, in fact, went back to England for a while and just opted out of the whole scene. But he came back to India in the 1930s. One of the characteristics of the British response to the nationalist movement was to try to give them incremental bits of change, but usually these were considered to be too little, too late by the nationalists. But by the 1930s, they saw the handwriting on the wall. They knew that they were going to have to leave sometime. They just hoped it would be later than the Nationalists wanted. And they put forward as a intermediary or transitionary stage the concept that limited elections could be held in India in the 1930s, which would give the Indians experience in government at the provincial level and would assign them various tasks that could give them administrative experience, things like running the education system and the health system and the waters and sewers. Of course, the British were going to hold on to the treasury and to the police and the ones that were the real levers of power, but this would be kind of a transitional thing. There was debate within the nationalist movement as to whether they should take this half a loaf as being better than none or whatever, but eventually what the Congress, the Indian National Congress was the name of the nationalist movement, what they decided to do was to contest the elections, which were held in 1935, as a way of demonstrating to the British that they, in fact, represented all Indians, and that the British could no longer say, well, you only represent this group, you don't really represent these kinds of minority groups. Because of what Gandhi had been doing for the last 15 years, they were tremendously successful in contesting these elections. Their Muslim candidates in these separate electorates won almost all the seats, as opposed to more individualistic Muslim parties. In various other minority groups, Congress candidates also won. So the Congress was full of itself. They said, we have demonstrated that we are a unified nationalist movement. We represent it all. And they were able to form ministries in all of these state provincial governments without any coalition partners, whatever. This put the Muslim League, this organization that had been headed by Jinnah, in the party of opposition. He was not offered a cabinet post. He wasn't offered a junior share in the government at all. Simply, in order to confirm this unity of the Congress, they were simply excluded. Well, as governments in power often do, mistakes were made. These ministries didn't always make the right decisions. They became susceptible to charges of corruption with this official or that official. And the Muslim League, now led by Jinnah, who had returned from England, began to stand up and say, see, this is what's going to happen if you allow these people to rule in an independent India. They're going to control all the levers of power. Any bad thing that happened could, of course, be grist for his mill. And when World War II broke out, and the British unilaterally declared India into the war, to the great chagrin and anger of the nationalist leaders, who were not even consulted in this move, they decided to launch an immediate campaign to oust the British with one last massive non-cooperation campaign. Again, if those of you who saw the Gandhi movie will remember that Gandhi then was hauled off for the rest of the war to be put under house arrest, as were almost all of the whole Congress leadership. Something like 60,000 were interned during the war. Jinnah and the Muslim League, however, were out, free and about, and as long as they didn't denounce the war, they were free to politicize as much as possible. He used that time to continually bring forward the slogan, Islam is in danger. And unless we get a separate state when the British leave, and the British during the war promised that they would leave after the war, unless we get that, our chances are doomed of ever having a society in which we can act as good Muslims ought to. Now, one of the reasons that Jinnah has been pilloried in Indian history for this is because most people clearly see this as a cynical political move on the part of Jinnah, who was, as I said, basically a secularist Muslim, who was not personally devout or pious, but who invoked the worst fears of the pious and devout as a way of accomplishing his political aims. I think there is some justification in that, although it it's not quite as simplistic, and by putting the black hat on Jinnah, it's too easy to blame him for the whole situation. There are other factors involved, but it certainly is an important issue, and that to a large degree, for good or ill, Jinnah is seen as the father of Pakistan, good as far as the Pakistanis are concerned, and bad as far as Indian nationalists who had hoped to retain unity of the whole subcontinent. Therefore, when partition took place in 1947, the scales had tipped dramatically in terms of the sentiment in the Islamic community in India. Whereas in 1935, almost all of the Muslims voted for the Congress in the various elections, by 1946, they were almost all in the camp of the Muslim League, the separatist organization. And since the British were eager to get out as soon as possible, they said the only solution is partition. If you're going to have independence, it has to be this way. Otherwise, we're not going to take into consideration the wishes of the Islamic community, which is now strongly in that camp. So Jinnah's ambition then led to the two-nation theory. The two-nation theory was that Islam was more than just a faith. Islam was a culture, a way of life, which demanded its own political system. Here was the first indication of somebody defining a nation and nationalism almost exclusively in terms of religious identity here in South Asia. No matter that they had a shared culture or history that dated back something like 700 years, those things didn't count for forming a nation, because both Hinduism and Islam required these larger dimensions of a whole social-political system and a cultural system that went with it, and the two were mutually exclusive. Since independence, then, Pakistan has been faced with what role ought Islam play in the state of Pakistan, because Pakistan was created as a Muslim state. It's its whole raison d'etre, its whole reason for being, is to be a Muslim state. It's always, though, had to struggle with what has that meant, and it certainly has always given it a built-in Muslim revivalist potential. If things don't go well, it must be because something relating the state and Islam has gone wrong. The history of Pakistan since its independence some 42 years ago now has not been a happy one, and in fact has tended to confirm the fact that Jinnah's idea that a nation can be built on a religious identity is wrong. You need more than that. And the most glaring example, of course, of that is the fact that there are now two Muslim nations in South Asia and not one. When Pakistan was created, there was, of course, tremendous concern about where the borders would be drawn. Essentially, the principle was adopted that wherever there were Muslim majorities, that would be Pakistan. Wherever there were not, that would be India. Well, the problem with this was, of course, that there were Muslim majorities in two parts of India. Up here on the northwest frontier, where there had been closest contact with the rest of the Islamic world, where many generations and Islamic groups had come through and invaded India, and understandably there have been larger numbers of Islamic settlers in that area. But the other was 1,000 miles away at the end of the Indo-Gangetic Plain in what was the eastern part of Bengal. Perhaps the question occurs to you, why? Why would there be a majority of Muslims here and not anywhere else? This makes sense, but why here? It's actually one of the interesting questions in Indian history, this process of conversion of Bengal to Islam, which was something that was underway then beginning about 1200 on. One of the theories is that this was one part of India in which Hinduism had not been very strongly established yet. Hinduism had been moving its way down the Gangetic Plain too at a much slower rate in the preceding centuries, and that it had not penetrated very deeply in terms of either time or roots into East Bengal. Another is that there were substantial numbers of Buddhists in East Bengal, and one of the things that can be somewhat correlated in terms of time, if not in terms of cause and effect, is that the demise of Buddhism in India seems to be correlated with the appearance of Muslims. Buddhism died out in India just about the time that Islam came in. Now, the one connection that is sometimes made is that Buddhism had become too highly dependent upon its small communities of monks, and that these were concentrated now in monasteries, which were easy targets for Muslim invaders, places where there may be gold images of the Buddha or something like that, so that they were attacked, sacked, the monks killed off, and without the monks, Buddhism could not be revived again. That's one possible connection, but there are other factors that are responsible for the decline of Buddhism in India besides that. But in any case, some people suggest that this was what happened in particularly in East Pakistan, that there had been substantial numbers of Buddhists out there who were eliminated in the Islamic conquest, and therefore it was possible to convert. Other conversions in India had tended to happen among untouchables, the lowest caste people, and also in urban areas, because the Muslim ruling elite tended to be primarily urban. So other than those two areas, the Muslim population in the rest of India was quite scattered, and there was no way in which you could, even if you may have had a majority Muslim city someplace, that could have been incorporated into Pakistan. This newly founded country then was one that was separated by 1,000 miles of Indian territory, and the only thing that the people had in common was the religion of Islam. They had had no cultural and historical contacts with one another before this. They spoke different languages. They ate different food. They had different clothing customs. Everything about it is different. After all, India is quite rightly called the subcontinent, and the way in which you need to think of India is that it is a peninsula of Eurasia like Europe is. Peninsulas tend to be cul-de-sacs, which tend to be characterized by a great deal of ethnic, linguistic, and cultural diversity. And that's what Europe is, and that's what South Asia or India is. India is quite analogous to Europe in that regard. And the differences then between the Bengalis in East Pakistan and the Punjabis and Sindhis and others in West Pakistan is just as great as the difference between a Sicilian peasant and a Finn in terms of Europe. So what else do they have in common? As I say, nothing. And the inevitable result was that Islam, that is, could not hold those two countries together, two halves of the same country. Particularly because although the majority of the area was in West Pakistan, in terms of the population, East Pakistan or Bangladesh was slightly more than half of the total population of the country. And yet, most of the bureaucrats, almost all of the army officials, and the other people who formed the ruling elite of the new country of Pakistan all came from the West. Well, they're not going to let one man, one vote put the eastern half in charge of the West when they had traditionally had these kinds of positions of power. And as a result, Pakistan staggered through a series of military dictatorships, never became a functioning democracy. The most recent election that was held in Pakistan in November here of 1988, in which Benazir Bhutto was chosen the most recent prime minister, is one of only two free elections that have ever been held in the history of Pakistan. And even the other one is free only in comparison to the other ways in which governments were put into power. The linkage of authoritarian rule, usually by military leaders then in Pakistan, with Islam has been one in which the ruler attempts to use Islam as a form of legitimation for his power and authority. Sometimes this has meant a back-to-the-basics approach, enforcement of Islamic law, the Sharia, on the populace in rather showy but not necessarily important ways. You establish a court that is supposed to review laws to test whether or not they are in accordance with Islam. You set up some parallel kinds of judicial structures. You set up state corporations which have interest-free banking because interest is not permitted under orthodox interpretation of Islam, and so on. But it doesn't necessarily have to be things that really dramatically affect the way in which people live. The way in which, though, the Muslim revival in to the West, to the Middle East, began to affect Pakistan was that it increased the pressure on the current military dictator of Pakistan at the time, Zia-ul-Haq, to implement more drastic forms of Islamization. He did this in part, I think, to forestall the kind of criticism that could well have come against his regime, which was unpopular for a variety of reasons, not least of which was the lack of political participation, but also the economic and social problems which characterized the country. So he began to push that even before it started as a popular grassroots movement there. And that's another of the differences with Pakistan compared to the revivalism elsewhere. In some ways, the state has been out front in Pakistan as a way of using it to manipulate the population for a couple of reasons, one of which I just mentioned. And as a result, opposition movements have tended to coalesce along ethnic and linguistic lines rather than along religious ones to this point. The religious issue, in other words, has sort of been preempted by the government in some ways. The last problem, though, that Islam was being used to paper over is the continual problem that has existed from the outset, and that's the question of developing an identity for what it means to be a Pakistani. Even in Pakistan itself, with the loss of Bangladesh, you have a great deal of ethnic diversity. Let me throw a map up here that is an older map showing the British outlines here. There are four main regions of Pakistan: Sindh, Baluchistan, what the British used to call the Northwest Frontier Province up here, which is essentially an Afghan-related population called the Pakhtuns, and the Punjab, which was split right down the middle. And part of it went to Pakistan and part of it went to India. Well, all of these are different linguistic groups. They have some of the same kinds of historical animosities and so forth that have characterized other divisions within Indian and Pakistani society. And the interesting corollary to all of this Islamization is that it seems to be failing again in Pakistan as a unifying ideology. There have been numerous ethnic riots in Karachi, which is in Sindh, between the Sindhis and migrants who have come from other parts of Pakistan. Particularly, most groups fear the Punjabis, who amount to about two-thirds of the population. The rest of them see themselves as threatened minorities. And you may find, in various cases, them adopting some kind of militant Islamic stance as a voice to express what are in fact primarily political ethnic grievances. But by and large, it's difficult for any kind of radical movement to use Islam and unify all of the various peoples within Pakistan because of these ethnic and linguistic differences. One other consequence of this Islamization that has been a negative one for unity in Pakistan has been that it, of course, accentuates sectarian differences within Islam. There are small numbers of Shia within Pakistan. Most of the population is Sunni, but there have been riots now since 1983 occurring at periodic levels between Shia and Sunni, something that didn't happen before, but now if you're going to talk about implementation of an Islamic state, whose state? What kind of vision? Is it going to be a Shia or a Sunni one? And this, again, has seemingly thwarted the plan to use Islam as a unifying ideology here. So the prognosis here is not, for as far as fundamentalism in Pakistan, is not, I think, likely to be a place where you're going to see it emerge as a unifying ideology. In fact, it probably will tend to be something that will accentuate divisions within Pakistan. What Pakistan needs, since it's a pluralistic society, and this is one of the problems that any society that invokes Islam as a unifying ideology will have, is that it needs to develop a political system in which cultural pluralism can be expressed adequately. And because it has not had that, it has had instead a series of military dictatorships in which there's been no real political participation of the government, of the people in the government. This is probably something that is going to be very difficult to form. But that's what they need. And Islam can't really provide that as a basis. If it doesn't happen, I would guess that there will be continued turmoil and the temptation again to use authoritarian rule. This is where Benazir Bhutto has got her work cut out for her. She's going to have to play coalition, balancing politics, insert the right amount of Islam, the right amount of social reform, balance, compromise all the time, but try in some way to create some kind of fragile unity out of a country that thought that Islam was enough at its beginning, but it wasn't enough. And now that's their dilemma. So who are we then if we're not Muslims? And what does it mean to be a Muslim? Still a problem that hasn't been solved in Pakistan.